I'm Brandi Cruz, coming up today on Undivided. Some might be quick to forgive and forget what Bob Ferguson has done over the last 12 years, but I won't be one of them. That doesn't mean we don't root for his success. Plus, we'll go over the three executive orders that Bob Ferguson signed on his first day in office, and Florida is all in on carrying out Trump's plans for mass deportation. That and more coming up today on Undivided. Remember, you can support our little old podcast for just $5 a month by signing up at undividedpod.com. Hello and welcome to Undivided. Thank you for being here. Thank you so much for your commitment to giving common sense a comeback. I'm Brandi Cruz. I feel like I need to start today's show with kind of a disclaimer. I'm struggling right now. I'm struggling with how to make sense, I think, of Bob Ferguson's sudden, very conservative, very common sense beliefs. So let me just say, you know, I've been on the phone this morning, also last night, fielding some messages and texts from some Republicans and also some Democrats who've been very critical of our new governor, Bob Ferguson, about, oh, you know, how refreshing it is to hear some of the things that he's saying around budgeting and public safety and all of this. And they're very optimistic. And I have been very hard on Bob. I don't know if there is someone who's been more critical of Bob Ferguson than I have been on this show. And that will not change. I mean, people in positions of power need to have a robust media that's critical of them. And Lord knows that the mainstream media and legacy media in Washington state has abandoned that responsibility entirely. So let me, the disclaimer I want to give before I get into this is that I, in case it's not clear, and it hasn't been clear, I want Bob Ferguson to succeed. I pray to God that he means some of the things that he's saying. If Bob Ferguson does well, that means our state does well. And at the end of the day, that's all I want. I don't care who puts our state on a better path forward. I don't care if Bob Ferguson gets to do a victory lap because he's made homelessness better or crime better or housing more affordable. If it's Bob Ferguson who makes those things better, great. I want to see our state succeed. I want to see every person in our state succeed. I want the middle class to be able to afford their freaking lives for once. I want them to not feel so crushed under the weight of increased taxes. I want them not to feel so crushed under the weight of the government and to be able to live their lives in the way they see fit and not have so much of their hard-earned money taken from them. So I want all of those things. And if it's Bob Ferguson that ushers that period of time in our state in, then that's great. I think that's fine. And I will be the first one to pat him on the back and to shake his hand and say, good work. So I understand why, and we're going to get into some of his remarks in his first address to the legislature. I understand why some Republicans are very excited by what he said. I understand why they're out making public statements praising Bob Ferguson for some of these things. They are in a very different situation than I am in my safe podcast studio behind a microphone. These Republican politicians have to work with him. Whether they like him or not, he's the governor. And if they want to affect change, if they want to get their bills across the line, they have to be optimistic that he means what he says. And if he's extending an olive branch to them to say, hey, I want to work with you on some of your priorities, they haven't been offered an olive branch in 12 years. And so I do not blame any Republican who is eager to work with Bob Ferguson to better the lives of their constituents. I think that's a very, very good thing. What I don't want to get lost in there is the reality of his track record. There's this sense I'm getting all over the internet from people who do what I do and just politicians and people who are very active in watching Washington State's political scene that, like, I feel like some people are being very quick to give him a clean slate, which is a mistake. So I think there's a fine line between hoping that he means what he says and trusting too much in what he says. You know, this is a guy, and I'll just say, I pulled this picture down today. If you want to know why I'm so passionate about this, and why I'm not letting Bob Ferguson off for the last 12 years. Every single day, Nicole and I sit in this studio and we do this job knowing full well the weight of our responsibility. And we take it very seriously. I've taken it seriously every day for 15 years. It's one of the reasons I'm so critical of the rest of the media, who seem perfectly fine ignoring the many, many shortcomings of politicians who they agree with. And Nicole and I sit in this studio every day, and up on the shelf behind us, out of your view up high, is always this picture of our friend Dory Monson that Cairo Radio was nice enough to let us keep, and his wife was nice enough to let us keep after he passed away. And one of the many reasons why it sits up there is not because we miss him and we love him, but it's because of what he taught us to do and the importance of watchdog journalism and the importance of not ever letting your guard down when it comes to a politician. And that's our, and the importance of understanding that that's our responsibility to all of you. We might have fun on this show and we might sit here and we might goof around sometimes and we want you to be entertained. But at the core of that is a fundamental belief that it is our job to hold the government accountable. And in our state, the government is the Democratic Party. And Bob Ferguson is a member of the machine and the party that has put our state on such a poor path. And so you'll forgive me if I am not so quick to say he gets a clean slate and he gets to stand up in front of the legislature and act like a moderate when he has been anything but. And some of the things that he has done aren't decades ago or even years ago. They're months ago or days ago. This is someone who spent the past 12 years fighting tooth and nail to erode your Second Amendment rights. This is someone who increased taxes by $1 billion on the King County Council. This is someone who wanted to criminalize wrong speech. This is someone who used the power of his office to politically prosecute police officers for murder. This is someone whose office was fined millions of dollars for trying to hide documents. One of the least transparent government offices I've ever covered in my life. This is someone who just a few months ago, who spent the last 18 months vilifying and lying about a principled conservative and dedicated public servant in Dave Reichert. Lying about him in every political campaign, every ad on TV, lying about his record. This is someone who's never stood up for law enforcement in his political career until it was politically advantageous for him to do so. Again, these things, someone who has spearheaded a domestic violent extremism task force that singular purpose seems to be vilifying conservatives and white people. And again, some of these things are days or just months ago. And all of a sudden you have so many people who one day in office, he says some nice things. And they're treating him like he never did any of that stuff. I have a problem with that. You know, no politician gets a clean slate, not from us. Do you think they're giving Donald Trump a clean slate? Do you think Donald Trump gets to be sworn in for his second term? And all of a sudden, all of the past is forgiven from Democrats? Of course not. So I would caution really anyone who's disappointed with how Bob Ferguson has conducted himself over the last 12 and really 25 years to be very cautious about believing outright some of the things he's saying now. That doesn't mean we don't want him to succeed. That doesn't mean that we don't hope and wish and pray that he means what he says. But you can do that while still keeping in mind all of the things he's done that helped Washington State get on this horrible path that we're on right now. And again, don't get me wrong, I'm going to go over some of what he said during his address to the legislature yesterday. And I was like floored. Like, oh my God, that's something I would have said. That's something a Republican would have said. He was being very bipartisan. Again, extending that olive branch to a minority party that has been completely ignored. But Bob Ferguson, at the end of the day, has had 25 years to show us this side of him, if it existed, and he never has. Ask yourself why. Someone who is a master chess player, who looks at his political career as a game of chess. So it would be a mistake not to be anticipating his next move. So with all of that, as Dory would say, as mere prelude, I do want to play for you some of what Bob Ferguson had to say. And look, this show is called Undivided. I will be open-minded. I will be open-minded, but I would be failing in my obligation to you and my duty as a member of the Fourth Estate if I did not compare everything he says now to things he has done or not done in the past. That is my job, and I will continue to do it. So that being said, I thought he had a very nice speech to the legislature, kind of a refreshing change of pace from former Governor Jay Inslee's sort of bumbling ramblings, nonsensical stuff. So he called in this inaugural address for the two parties to work together.
Let us listen to one another without consideration for party so that the strongest argument prevails. That is how we do our best work. And let me be specific with examples of how we can work in a bipartisan way.
And in being specific, he went out and actually called out Republican members of the legislature and some of the priorities that they have.
Representative Connors, I'm excited to work with you to get your Homes for Heroes legislation to my desk. Let's recognize the contributions of police officers, firefighters, behavioral health professionals, and other critical public servants and ensure they can access low-interest loans to purchase their first homes. Representative Dent, thank you for joining me for lunch at the Palace Cafe in Ellensburg. I share your commitment to supporting Washington farmers. By the way, that includes ensuring they receive the rebates they were promised under the Climate Commitment Act. Thank you.
Hell yeah!
Where are you, Senator Braun? There's so many faces in front of me. Senator Braun, I hope to work with you to adopt reasonable limits on the governor's emergency powers. We can do that together.
You could knock me over with a feather. That's insane. I love how at the end there when he says, let's establish reasonable limits on emergency powers, some on the Democratic side stand up and start to clap wildly. You know how many years we've been pushing for Democrats to cooperate with Republicans on putting some reasonable limits on emergency powers after Jay Inslee had a state of emergency for 975 days around COVID? And they're like, no. And now a new governor of their own party wants to do it. They're like, great idea. I mean, these people are absolute hypocrites. If they weren't hypocrites, they'd have nothing else. So that was a nice moment. I thought those were some nice moments. But again, you just have to consider Bob Ferguson was in a position to be able to say something about this stuff for the last 12 years. He was an independently elected official. He didn't work for the governor. The only thing he had with the governor was they belonged to the same political party. So because they belonged to the same political party, he never used his office and his power and his influence as attorney general even to step to a microphone and say, hey, 975 days of emergency rule is too much. You know, there's some people that are thinking we need to reform emergency powers. There's nothing that precluded him from saying that, except not having a backbone, except his political ambitions, except not wanting to run afoul of a governor of his own political party. So, and the same thing with the CCA. Right now, with the Climate Commitment Act, the state is violating the law. The Climate Commitment Act has written into it that ag is exempt from the increases at the gas pump that the CCA has put on them. Remember, we've talked a lot about this. Interesting that in the law that they claim doesn't have an impact on gas prices, they had to build in an exemption for ag so they weren't impacted by increased gas prices. Very strange, right? Very strange. But Bob Ferguson was the state's chief law enforcer. Bob Ferguson could have said, hey, right now we're in violation of this law by not giving ag an exemption. And unless we want to get sued, which I think they actually did get sued, we need to do something about it. He never said that. The CCA has been in effect for 2 years. Bob Ferguson never stood up and said, hey, there's an exemption for ag built into the law. Let's do something about it. I'm the state's lawyer. We got to make this happen so we don't get sued and pay out a bunch of money. So again, nice words. Wonderful words. His actions tell a different story. If he's had a change of heart, great. I welcome it. But he doesn't get forgiveness for what he said and did or didn't do just a few months ago. He also talked about what his kind of rules will be when he considers budgetary bills or the budget that comes to his desk.
We should have an open and honest dialogue about how we arrived at this shortfall and what lessons we must learn.
Let us
work together to ensure that we correct some of the actions that brought us here. But let me start by saying that the era of assuming unrealistic growth in revenue is over. To be specific, I will not sign a budget that requires unrealistic revenue growth to balance. Moreover, I will veto policy bills that defer major spending obligations more than 4 years after the legislation is adopted. These bills violate the spirit of Washington's requirement that state budgets be balanced over a four-year period.
Love it. I think that's all great. If I had nothing in between here and here, I would say this guy is awesome. But of course, we have the knowledge that he doubled the size of his office as Attorney General and that he signed off on $1 billion in tax increases during his time as a King County Council member. So the phrase is usually trust but verify. I'm going to be skeptical and I'm going to verify because this is a whole new Bob Ferguson. And if he was so cowardly that he hid this side of him for all these years when he was in a position of great influence, then that doesn't say very much about him either, if he's always testing the political winds. And I have to say, again, the media just buys it hook, line, and sinker. Like, is it really that hard? Genuinely. I know I give my opinion. I'm not asking the media to give their opinion. But it's not an opinion to say, here's what he said, but here's how that's in conflict with what he's done. Is that an opinion? No, that's just a fact. Here's what he said. Here's how that's in conflict with this. He says he wants $100 million to fund more law enforcement positions. He didn't say anything about police defunding for several years. He prosecuted police officers for murder, which some agencies have said made it more difficult for them to recruit more officers because they didn't want to work for him. That's not an opinion. That's just holding a powerful person accountable. Here's, honest to God, a tweet I saw from the Seattle Times, which the Seattle Times is just, please cancel your subscriptions. They don't deserve your money. Governor Bob Ferguson's inaugural speech showed how he may be distancing himself from former Governor Jay Inslee, and that he may not be as aligned with Democratic lawmakers as his predecessor. He has been lockstep with them for 12 years. He hasn't pushed back against them at all for 12 years. He's walked alongside them during efforts to unwind police, the ability of police to protect people, during his bills that he introduced in the legislature to erode Second Amendment rights. He has been absolutely hand in hand with them for 12 years. He gives one nice speech with some bipartisan words, and the Seattle Times says, well, maybe he's not aligned with Democratic lawmakers as much as you think. Okay, but like, you guys aren't dumb, I know that. So compare that to the last 12 years. So all of a sudden, because of one speech, 12 years, or really 25 years, just goes out the window, and you're giving him a clean slate, and you now believe him? It's very, I mean, again, that's what the media does, and that's why we're not going to do that. I will absolutely encourage him every step of the way. Hell, maybe he'll get to the point where he's being so common sense that he'll come on the show. I don't know, I'd welcome him on the show. But I'm not going to let one speech outweigh 25 years of a track record that isn't very good. I will say, one thing I did enjoy, though, is because we said he's sounding like a Republican. Right now, if that's who he is, we have a moderate Republican in the governor's office. And the far left hates it. And I kind of love that. I love that there's already this anger about, oh, he's a corporate Democrat. So Sean Scott, who's a socialist, who got elected by voters in Seattle to represent them in Olympia, so he's now a new state representative, he tweeted this out. Governor Ferguson's inaugural ball tonight is hosted by the Chamber of Commerce with a swearing-in speech that made no mention of taxing the rich to fund services we all use. Many Washingtonians may wonder whether his economic agenda is as well. That's interesting. I don't know. It kind of doesn't make a lot of sense. But first of all, you can show he's new to Olympia. The inaugural ball is always hosted by the Chamber of Commerce. That's just because it's sort of a thing that brings people to town. So the inaugural ball is always hosted by the Chamber of Commerce. But the insinuation he's making there is clear. It's like Bob Ferguson's beholden to corporations. And again, like there's this guy, Bob Ferguson made every effort on the campaign trail to distance himself from businesses. And to say, oh, I'm not taking money from corporate PACs and all this stuff. He took a ton of money from unions or whatever it is. But now, oh, he's being too pro-business. Isn't talking about taxing the rich. So now the new socialist in Olympia is mad at him. I kind of love that. So if Bob Ferguson can continue to make the socialist angry, I think that's a good sign. I think that's a positive sign. I love that, though. No mention of taxing the rich to fund services we all use. socialism. No push of socialism during that speech. All right. And then the other thing is, you know, there were obviously a lot of good moments in the speech that I think, if he means it, are great. But, you know, Bob Ferguson is still there. He spent 8 years fighting tooth and nail against Donald Trump, obsessed over Donald Trump on the campaign trail, obsessed over the fear-mongered voters over the issue of abortion, despite the fact it's been codified in our state since the early 1970s, and there is no threat to abortion access here. And he's still, you know, he's still got that stuff. He still is going to talk about that stuff. He brought it up during his speech.
Let me be very clear. My administration will work with President Trump where we can. We will stand up to him when we must. And that most certainly includes protecting Washingtonians' reproductive freedom. That's why I'm taking action today to protect those freedoms. The times call for action. Immediately following this speech, I will sign an executive order directing the Department of Health to convene a roundtable of medical providers, reproductive health experts, and policymakers to recommend strategies for protecting reproductive freedom.
So there you have your virtue signaling. I mean, that's all that is. That is absolute virtue signaling. Abortion access is fine in Washington state. It's codified. This is why we were so critical of the fear-mongering on the campaign trail around abortion, 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 abortion. But maybe he had to throw them a bone, right? So he had three executive orders that he signed on his first day in office. One of them was the abortion one. We're going to have a round table of doctors. When we have like some of the strongest abortion protections in the nation, it's just ridiculous. The other two have to do with permitting reform, which I love. It sounds very Doge-like, trying to fast track permitting and licensing. And also the housing one is interesting. Let's start there. So we know that he's promised all these new units of housing, like 200,000 net in his first term. Housing is a big issue. We're not just talking about like affordable housing units. We're talking about middle income housing units so people can afford to buy a house in Washington state. One of the things that adds a lot of money onto the cost of homes is all the red tape and bureaucracy that is associated with trying to build a house in Washington state. One of his executive orders on housing, he says, is going to help with that.
Washingtonians need more housing, lots more housing. We must make it easier, faster, and less expensive to build housing of all kinds. The times call for action, and that is why I'm signing an executive order immediately following this speech, directing state agencies to review all regulations that impact housing, permitting, and construction, and identify any provision that can be streamlined, deferred, or eliminated. This issue is critical.
Yeah, so great idea. The proof is in the pudding. Obviously, an executive order is just a piece of paper directing people to try to do something. Are they going to do it? I think that's TBD. And then his third executive order had to do with streamlining, permitting, and licensing.
Our mission must be to speed up government, improve customer service, and center the people in every decision we make. Let me give you an example. If a Washingtonian applies for a permit, they need that permit delivered on time. Time is money for that Washingtonian and their business. And if the permit is late, why should that Washingtonian still pay for it? That changes now. Immediately after this speech, I'm signing an executive order directing all state agencies to cut down their permit and license processing times. We'll establish quick and transparent deadlines for all agencies to meet. And if an agency does not meet its deadline, they'll refund your application fee.
Love that. Love it. So if he can make the executive order turn into action, streamline things, get rid of red tape and bureaucracy, that benefits everyone. I wish him well. The housing one in particular is going to be difficult. There are a ton of regulations around putting up new housing. And Bob Ferguson can only deal with part of it. I mean, because you have regulations that are at the city level and the county level, and so you can do what you want to do at the state level. The question is, will it make a big difference? And this matters to all of us. If you can cut down permitting and regulation, then presumably the cost of home ownership goes down. And so for any of you watching who have been trying to buy a home or maybe trying to get out of your starter home or something, this stuff is going to be significant if it can be done. So we asked Jan Heimbaugh with the Building Industry Association of Washington to join us briefly today just to react to this executive order and to help us understand what impact, if any, it will have on the cost of home ownership. Jan Heimbaugh, welcome back to Undivided.
Good to be here. Thanks, Brandy.
Well. Governor Ferguson, so releases these executive orders. Did BIAW have any input on the housing EO?
We have been engaged with some of the transition work, but not a ton of effort. We were happily surprised to see those executive orders yesterday.
Well, this is something that BIAW has been on with us numerous times talking about, the frustration. Like, you want us to build more houses. We want to build more houses, yet you're making it incredibly difficult and expensive for us to do so. So this executive order isn't a list of things they're going to do. It's essentially almost a promise to look into it, I guess. So where do you... what do you hope the next steps are?
Yeah, you know, it was a nice thing to see, a good step forward. Self-assessment by government is usually not the most honest, but hopefully we can engage in these reviews and processes to show the governor and his agencies where they are holding up development, where they are adding cost drivers unnecessarily, whether it's at the State Building Code Council through our energy codes and our building codes, whether it's at the Department of Labor and Industries, the fact that if you have an injured worker, you cannot call and leave a message for a claim manager at LNI before 8 a.m. or after 5 p.m. To leave a message, right? Those things actually do delay housing because we're not getting our workers back and healthy, or whether it's commerce adding additions to what permit reform bills, definitions to permit reform bills, or changing the definition of land swaps so you can build here, not here, and switch around, or adding additional requirements to the middle housing bill, which is supposed to increase housing and design standards that say you can't have a garage on the front of a middle housing that's more than 50% of the frontage space. That just adds costs and drives delay and adds, make sure that we're not building as many units. So I hope that this is an honest assessment. Maybe ecology will process a water bank transfer at some point, because all those things play into delay in housing and adding costs. So.
Well, what do you think it was? I mean, he made this promise on the campaign trail. I think he said in his first term, 200,000 new net units of housing, right? So if you don't consider this executive order when he was making those promises, because he's not the first governor who's been like, we need more housing, or the first elected official. When he made that kind of pledge on the campaign trail, absent this, did you think it was feasible?
I mean, 200,000 units over that amount of time is very aggressive, given our current systems. And it's not just the state systems, it's local governments too. The state can reform all its permit processes, and if a local government doesn't want development, you're not going to have development there. They're going to put in excessive impediments into the ability to permit stuff, whether it's fees, whether it's time, whatever. But we do need more housing. So, you know, we always appreciated that he was talking about housing supply overarchingly, not just sort of dump money into government programs to build housing. We need all kinds of housing. You've got to do all types of development in order to make the people who are at the very low income spectrum be able to have homes, and the people who are in the middle have homes. You need it all. So,
yeah. So 200,000 aggressive. And I think that's one of the things, you know, with the previous governor, former governor Inslee, it's weird to call him that now. He would set a lot of goals, you know, but the goals would never really manifest into anything. And they were very lofty, and goals are fine, but if it's a goal just to set a goal that you never meet, it's sort of like, well, what's the point? So he had that goal on the campaign trail. Now he has this, where he's saying, this is one of my big issues. Do you think if they can cut down on permitting that 200,000 is feasible?
I think if they can cut down on permitting, and then they can cut down on some of the cost inputs that the state and local governments are driving into developing housing, that it is possible. Right now, 2 years ago, Senator Mullett passed a permit reform bill. It was unanimous in both chambers. It's being implemented right now. There's already pushback from local governments about actually processing permits on time and, you know, doing these things and actually tracking how their permit timelines are working and things like that. So it's like they've had 2 years to implement it. And now they're like, we can't do this. So you've got to sort of make sure that those local governments are accountable to the reforms that the state has already done. And we need a significant more amount of reforms to get to the point where we're able to build enough housing, let alone accessible, affordable housing to all aspects of the, you know, economic ladder. So it's not just about, right, this is just about units. Mm-hmm. It's not even about, are they affordable units?
Right.
Right.
Yeah.
So,
well, and that's what I was going to say, but in theory, and just two more quick questions on this, in theory, if you're cutting down on permitting and you're cutting down on then the time it takes to build a home, we know, I think it's like $10,000, what, every couple weeks that's added to the cost of a home if there's a delay in permitting. So in theory, if they get this moving faster for builders like your members, the homes would be less expensive, would they not?
Yeah. So a couple of years ago, and we haven't updated the study, but I think in like 2022, the cost of permit delays on average in Washington State was $30,000 to the cost of a home. And that's like, we're carrying interest, which is higher than your typical mortgage interest. Interest is high right now. So a typical delay in Washington State is a $30,000 price tag onto the cost of the home. And then, you know, you've got to get a mortgage on that, just 30%, $30,000, and then 7%. It expands whatever. This is actually, this represents, this is about $30,000. This is our little fake money stack.
Yeah.
That's delay on one house, right? So that's a lot of money.
Yeah, it is. Especially when they say that one of the predominant issues we're facing is a lack of affordable housing. Okay, well, get out of the way, you know, get out of the way.
Right.
So I'll just end with this, because you already talked about one of the impediments is local government. And are they going to cooperate with this and do what they need to do to help you guys along? This doesn't happen overnight. Like, an executive order is one thing. It's a great place to start. But even if they get some recommendations, let's say in the next few months, and start to cut red tape, how long before your members really see that while they're out building homes and planning for what homes to build?
I mean, I think there's some things that could be done today that would impact and be improvements for tomorrow. But I think long term, you know, it'll be 6 months to a year before you actually see, at shortest, before you actually see real sort of increase in production times, because we are relying on, we do, you know, performas and financing and stuff, and we're thinking from like looking at a piece of land to actually building, like digging and doing actual work on a lot for a building permit, or after you get to like actually building the house, is like 5 to 6 year period. So you're already in a pipeline here, and you've got your cash flow set out and your financing flow and your whatever flow of, like, assuming you factor in the delay costs into your financing. So we've changed the system wholeheartedly. You know, I get all of my hopes and dreams tomorrow. You've already got stuff in the pipeline. They have to get fulfilled those things before they can start new projects that are actually work as we would love them to work.
Yeah, that's what I figured. It's going to be something that we won't see manifest right away. But this is promising, promising.
Yep.
Well, I hope that BIAW has a seat at the table as they discuss all of these things. So I'm sure we'll check back in with you on it, Jan. Thank you so much.
Would love to be back. Thanks, Brandy.
Yeah, so those are things we've talked a lot about on the show. If he wants to address them, great. Bob Ferguson, go get it. A+. We'll give you all the credit in the world. These executive orders, though, just say we need to look into this. We need to see what recommendations come out of them, or whether it's just another one of those little round table task forces that don't ultimately do anything at the end of the day. So, and I would also say of Bob Ferguson's sudden shift, the biggest tests are yet to come. There are some bills winding their way through Olympia this session that are far left fringe nutty bills. Pay for striking, unemployment benefits for striking workers, unemployment benefits for illegal immigrants. A bill that would allow basically any sentencing judge to just say, oh, you know, you've learned your lesson behind bars, so I'm going to cut your sentence short. Things like that. So, you know, I think the true test of whether he's actually going to be the moderate he claims to be is what he does if those bills get to his desk, not to mention the new taxes that Democrats are proposing, taxes on the rich, taxes on businesses, and an increase in your property taxes, which no one can afford right now. And on top of that, the biggest test of all, how unhinged we get about Donald Trump. This is an attorney general who, more so than any attorney general in the country, fought hard against Donald Trump every single step of the way, whether Washington had a true dog in the fight or not. So you're going to see a lot of tension when it comes, especially to the immigration issue, which we'll get to in Florida Report a little bit later on. So there's a lot. I mean, this is day one. Said some nice things, made you feel warm and fuzzy. But there is still a lot ahead this session that is going to be a true test for Bob Ferguson on which side he lands on. Does he land on the side of sanity or insanity? We will find out. All right, so we're talking about housing and all of that, but maybe you don't care because maybe you want to live the RV life. And you know what? I think the RV life is great. The RV life is particularly great if you have a lot at Natchez RV Resort. Natchez RV Resort has a new phase of their grand opening coming up January 25th and 26th, and these are the best properties in the entire resort. So if you've been thinking about it, these are the lots that you want to snag. 25 premium extra large RV lots with amazing unobstructed views. So talk about privacy. Nothing's going to be built behind these lots. So you're not going to have anyone behind you. It's going to be great. So you can schedule your showing for January 25th or 26th, NatchezRVResort.com, NatchezRVResort.com. They also have their pool and hot tub open, their 4,300 square foot clubhouse, which is just beautiful. It's got a gourmet kitchen, great room, fitness center, plenty of room when you have friends and family come to visit, to hang out, showers, laundry, all that stuff. So NatchezRVResort.com, NatchezRVResort.com. Schedule your showing for the 25th and 26th. Today. All right. We surprised you guys with a little live Q&A with Brian Haywood of Let's Go Washington. He was coming in and we weren't so sure if we were going to do it live, and we decided to pop him on live to do a Q&A. So if you were taken off guard by it, it's because it was a surprise. But we talked earlier on this week about the fact that Democrats in Olympia are already trying to undo the Parental Bill of Rights. They passed the initiative into law last year because they thought it would be more beneficial for them to pass it, come back and change it, than to send it to voters to pass. So we now know that they are taking a blowtorch to it. You know, one of the big reasons why the Parental Bill of Rights Initiative 2081 got so much support is parents were frustrated that they weren't being told about what was happening with their kids at school. Like, kids were getting prescribed medications through schools. You know, that they could go to school and identify as a different gender and a different name, and the school wouldn't tell them. So the Parental Bill of Rights Initiative, which is now law, says that parents are the primary stakeholder in their kids' lives, and they get to know what happens with their kids at school from a medical perspective, from a mental health perspective, from a disciplinary perspective. This is common sense stuff, but not according to Senate Majority Leader Jamie Peterson, who dropped a bill that basically takes a big fat marker through all of these various elements that were critical to the whole purpose of the Parental Rights Initiative in the first place. So they just want to upend it. So I had Brian Haywood on yesterday. We did a Q&A in the afternoon just to talk about kind of where do we go from here. Here's a part of it in case you missed it. Besides reaching out to legislators, what else can they do? That's what she wants to know.
I think the mass response has. So it's not just your legislators. You have to reach out to them. But I think what has to happen is enough people besides you. So if you can get five people and those people can get five people, yeah, that will begin to be the thing that changes. There was some legislation a while back that was trying to regulate beauticians. And the beauticians got mad,
right? Oh, my God, I remember
mad,
this.
Right? And they rose up. And you can go to the Capitol and you can testify. You can find out when the bill, like if there's a vote on it or whatever, you can go there. But I think that right now it's the response. One of the things that's interesting, too, though, is, you know, if you're not in Jamie Peterson's district.
Senator Jamie Peterson, Seattle.
If you're not in his district, the website will not allow you to send him a note that you disapprove of this.
Isn't that,
even though he's
his,
the Senate leader.
Right, you have to find his individual email and you can contact his office and stuff.
Right.
But it makes it really easy for you to contact your legislator, but yes, it's a little more difficult to track down information for legislators who aren't your own.
I think if you're the Senate Majority Leader, you should not be blocked from hearing people from the whole state because you're driving the whole agenda.
Well, and the other issue I would say is if they really believe that aspects of the Parental Bill of Rights, the Parental Rights Initiative, violate federal laws around privacy for kids, the avenue to deal with that is through the courts. The avenue, right, is not to go in and just completely cross those sections out of a law that was created by the voters.
Well, to your earlier point, if they, you know, if they said, well, we think that there's some things that are wrong with this that need to be fixed, I would expect one or two paragraphs that might be out of compliance, mm-hmm, but if you start going through this, it's page after page after page.
It is absolutely to death.
Deletions, yeah.
Oh my God, it's insane.
Information about vocational training.
Why would a parent not need to know about information about vocational training?
Records of attendance, including unexcused absences.
Why would a parent not need to know about that? This is insane stuff, what they're doing. And it's anti-democratic, 100%. Yeah, so we need to make sure that we speak out about it often as this bill winds its way through. Let them know, like, hey, this was the people's initiative. Parents, almost 500,000 people wanted the Parental Bill of Rights. And if you're just going to go in and make it a skeleton of what it once was, what's the point? I mean, it's totally anti-democratic. So email Senator Jamie Peterson and your state representative and state senator and let them know that you're frustrated that they would have the audacity to come back less than a year later and completely upend your rights as a parent. So we appreciate Brian Haywood jumping on with us kind of last minute notice yesterday. That full interview is up, no paywall, across all of our platforms, so you can hear our whole conversation. All right. We talked earlier about socialist Sean Scott, one of the newest members of the State House in Olympia. We thought we'd look at, you know, what his first bill is out. What is the socialist introducing? Before we get to that in our segment Unbelievable, I've encouraged you guys to take the First Mark Challenge. It's a quick way to see if you can save thousands of dollars a year on your insurance. I always say it's a no-brainer because it doesn't cost you anything. So rather than, you know, just getting the insurance policy you think is the best, have the experts look at it at First Mark. Spencer says he took the First Mark Challenge. Chase at First Mark helped him. They were able to save him $1,600 a year by consolidating his boat, cars, and motorcycles to one insurer. Chad says that he went to First Mark for his car, house, and pet insurance because he's got a service animal. He said First Mark was honest with him. They weren't able to help with his car or house to get a better deal, but they did get him pet insurance for his service dog, Sergeant, and saved him over $100 a month. So that's more than $1,200 a year. And we get these stories nonstop from undivided viewers and listeners who take the First Mark Challenge. And I think the fundamental sort of underlying theme of those comments is, why did I not do this sooner? Amen. Why am I saying amen so much on the show today? Am I going to find Jesus? I joked on X the other day. I don't know if I'm able to find Trump and Jesus all in the course of 1 year. That might be too much.
Wow.
So, you know, let's not go crazy. That would be quite the year. Anyway, firstmarkinsurance.com, firstmarkinsurance.com. The very best part is they work for you. All right. Seattle sent socialist Sean Scott to the State House in Olympia where he's doing his thing. I heard a rumor that he knelt like during the national anthem or something.
Yes, we had a listener there that said that's what
I haven't been able to confirm it, but that wouldn't surprise me. He was like very into the BLM sort of thing, but he's a showboat, right? He desperately needs attention, which is annoying when you're down and you're in a room full of mostly adults who have a lot to do and you all eyes on you. So he's going to be an absolute like desperate for attention lawmaker. But anyway, let's check in on what his first bill that he's prime sponsored is in our segment, Unbelievable. All right. Honestly, if I had to have guessed, like, okay, we know Sean Scott, very anti-police, pro-domestic extremism on the left, loves when they shut down highways and stuff, hates big businesses, tax Amazon and stuff. If I had to, like, kind of guess what his first bill would be, it would either be, like, some anti-cop thing or some anti-business thing. He went with anti-business. So House Bill 1313 is the first bill he's the prime sponsor on, and he wants to regulate layoffs. If you own a business with more than 100 employees and you find yourself in a predicament because of the economy or whatever it is where you're going to have to conduct layoffs, he wants to regulate them so that you have to give more notice. So you have to bring in all these people to kind of help your employees with the transition after they're laid off. So let's see. It says an employer may not order a mass layoff, relocation, or termination at a covered establishment. So that's if you're over 100 employees. Unless 60 days before the order goes into effect, the employer has given written notice of the order. So yeah, you need to lay off employees because you have an urgent, like let's say you had an order cancellation or you can't keep your financial head above water because of some significant change in the environment or the economy of your business. Well, you got to keep them on the payroll for 60 days. You got to give them at least 60 days notice.
You better have a money tree or you better pull some out of your ass, I guess.
Yep, I guess you got to find that money from somewhere.
Guess you got to figure it out.
You lay off employees because financially you're in an emergency. You don't do a mass layoff situation like out of no need or necessity.
Right.
And so it's like all these restrictions on how you have to go about conducting a mass layoff. Now, a relocation, maybe I understand that one a little bit more. If you're Amazon and you're planning to relocate, which you probably should at this point, to a different state, you got a lot of time, right? There's a lot of time between when you're going to pick up and leave. But I think this is assuming that a company wouldn't give employees notice that they're going to relocate their entire business somewhere else. And it, you know, the other thing is, and I'm just going to say it, like, this is a free market, right? If you're having to lay off employees, I'm sure that most businesses value their employees and they want to give their employees as much notice as possible that layoffs are coming or whatever it is. But like, if you had to give them 60 days written notice, you know how many of those employees are just going to leave right away? Like, they're not going to, they're under no obligation to. But basically, if they're like saying, oh, I've got 60 days notice, you might lose half of them by the time that 60 days are done. So I just, it's overregulation of businesses. So, but it doesn't surprise me, right? That's not surprising. Here's the dumbest part of it all. As part of this bill, because it cannot be a Sean Scott bill unless there's some identitarianism woven throughout it, some sort of like woke agenda. As part of this bill, the legislature is going to study and try to figure out, quote, whether mass layoffs result in a disproportionate dismissal of employees belonging to protected classes and whether certain groups of employees are laid off more than others. So again, it all has to be about race, gender, all of this stuff. And this tells you a lot about Sean Scott, that he believes the worst in businesses and business owners. He assumes the worst of police officers. He assumes the worst of white people. He assumes the worst of businesses and business owners. So it's his assumption, I think, that the legislature is going to study this issue. And they're going to determine that when businesses go to lay people off, they're doing it based on the color of that person's skin. Or they're doing it based on that person's gender identity or immigration status or whatever it is. So they want to paint businesses as the bad guy. They want to make it more difficult for businesses to do what they need to do from a business perspective. Nobody likes layoffs. Layoffs aren't fun. Layoffs aren't good for anyone. They're not good for the business. They're not good for the employee. That doesn't mean the government should be in the business of regulating when and how quickly you can lay employees off. And then, of course, Democrats need to make sure. And what are they going to do if they find out that there's a disproportionate number of Black people who are subjected to layoffs? Are they going to, what are they going to do with that information? Are they going to say to businesses, you can't lay off Black people? You can't lay off immigrants? Genuinely, what are they going to do with that information? Because they'll find whatever they need to find to fit their narrative. They're never going to do a study on this and come out and say, actually, there's no disproportionate impacts of layoffs. They will find whatever information supports their theory that protected groups of people are subject to more layoffs, even if it doesn't exist. The question is, what are they going to do with it? Similar to their domestic violent extremism task force. What are you going to do when you start to identify who's committing domestic violent extremism in your minds? Wrong speech. So yeah, what are you going to do? Tell businesses like, hey, if you're planning mass layoffs, it has to meet demographics. So 70% of the people you lay off, you have to choose them by their skin tone. It could be white, and then this 8% can be Black, 4% can be Asian Pacific Islander. What are you going to do? And 1% can be transgender. You have to absolutely meet the demographics. It's just unbelievably stupid stuff. All right. If you're thinking about selling your home in 2025, maybe you're going to pick up stakes, move somewhere a little nicer, weather nicer politically. Reach out to our friend Wes Jones at sellwithwes.com, sellwithwes.com. Wes and his team have an innovative marketing strategy to make sure that your listing truly shines, not just on paper, not just on the internet, but in person. Wes was telling us that, you know, the real estate market has been a little slow, and because of that, buyers might have an expectation going into a showing that the house is going to not be a project for them, for instance. And that is something that Wes and his team can help with.
You know, I'm hearing a lot of things. People are like, oh gosh, well, you know, there might be a recession coming up. I'm like, hey guys, anybody working in real estate has been living it for like the last 30 months or so. It's a strange conundrum though, because sales are low, but prices are still very, very high. You can still sell and you can plan on making a lot of money, but you might have to prepare your home a little bit harder and do a little bit more work than you have in the past because buyers are a little bit, you know, less forgiving.
Yeah, and that's what they're listing Boost Concierge Services for. You come in, he can help you manage projects, even pay for it up front to help you out, just kind of lift that stress and that financial burden out of the process of selling your home and getting it ready for sale. So sellwithwest.com, sellwithwest.com, a better way to sell your home. All right, some national news. So love the news that the ceasefire agreement between Israel and what's happening in Gaza and the release of hostages. Fascinating that this comes a few days before Donald Trump is going to be sworn in. There's also some other things going on. Like Nicole was telling me when we were in one of these tapings that the FBI just got rid of its DEI department.
Yeah, its diversity department.
Because they're like, this isn't going to survive. So there's all these things in California. We'll talk about this on the show next week, sort of like abandoning some of its low carbon fuel standards because they're not going to be approved by the Trump administration. So a lot of people doing things in anticipation of Donald Trump. And if you don't think that Hamas is doing this because Donald Trump's coming into office, like, I don't know how to help you with that one. It's been a year and a half since the attack on Israel, since some of these hostages were taken. If anyone wants to say that this is finally Joe Biden in his final days of office securing this and not fear from Hamas that they will be wiped off the face of the planet once Donald Trump comes into office, like, that's what it is. That's what strength does, and the peace through strength mentality. So Biden came out and announced this ceasefire deal. Here's that.
This is the ceasefire agreement I introduced last spring.
Today, it was me.
Hamas and Israel have agreed to that ceasefire agreement.
Why didn't they agree last spring?
You know, the Bible says, blessed are the peacemakers. Many peacemakers help make this deal happen, including an extraordinary team of American diplomats who have worked nonstop for months to get this done. Secretary Blinken led the effort. Secretary Jake Sullivan, National Security Advisor Jake Sullivan, Bill Byrne, John Finer, Brett McGurk, Amos Hochstein, and the Vice President worked relentlessly as we worked to deliver this deal.
And I have no doubt that there were a lot of people who were involved in it. And again, I go back to what I said at the beginning of the show. I don't care who does it and who gets credit for it, as long as it gets done, as long as some of those hostages get to go back to their families. But let's not be ridiculous about it. Surely he is going to acknowledge that Donald Trump and the incoming administration helped with this.
Thank you. Folks, credit for this, Mr. President, you or Trump?
Is that a joke? Oh, thank you.
Okay, maybe not. But his own State Department sure acknowledged Trump's involvement.
When it comes to the involvement of President-elect Trump's team, it has been absolutely critical in getting this deal over the line.
Poor Biden. And look, I am sure that it was a cooperation between the two. I mean, there's a difference between an incoming administration and its ability to broker something like this versus the current administration. It's not going to happen without the current administration being involved. Nobody believes that. But this idea that for, what was it? So it would be October, so a year and a half, right? This idea that a year and a half has gone by and Biden says, this is my ceasefire deal from the spring. Okay, well, what changed? What changed from the spring? What changed from the spring to now? Donald Trump was elected. You weren't. Kamala Harris wasn't. And now Donald Trump is about to be sworn in as the 47th president of the United States. And Donald Trump don't play no shit. So even Benjamin Netanyahu, this was like the ultimate troll. So, and I'm only, I mean, this is serious news. This is good news. I mean, I think, again, trust and verify that Hamas does what it says it's going to do. But, you know, Biden's out there and he's having this, like, I did this, my administration, our stuff, like, doesn't even, is this a joke that Donald Trump? Here is what Israel posted on X. Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu spoke this evening with U.S. President-elect Donald Trump and thanked him for his assistance in advancing the release of the hostages and for helping Israel bring an end to the suffering of dozens of hostages and their families. The prime minister made it clear that he is committed to returning all of the hostages however he can and commended the U.S. president-elect for his remarks that the U.S. would work with Israel to ensure that Gaza will never be a haven for terrorism. So they put out that nice statement thanking president-elect Donald Trump for all of this. Here's what they said about Joe Biden. Prime Minister Netanyahu then spoke with U.S. President Joe Biden and thanked him as well for his assistance in advancing the hostage deal. All these things about Donald Trump, and like he also spoke with Joe Biden. That's it. So look, the deal is good no matter how we got here. I just don't like the disingenuous, like, hey, if Trump had something to do with it, like the State Department, give him credit for that. again, there is a difference when how you conduct yourself as a country, what you say, when you have your allies back, when you show that you're going to do, that you mean what you say, that you're going to do. I mean, Pete Hegseth just this week was in front of the Senate for his confirmation hearing to be defense secretary. And I don't remember the exact quote, but he talked about, like, I support Israel wiping Hamas off the face of the planet. It's like, that's peace through strength, right? And yeah, terrorists, they don't want to die. They might be, you know, there might be some of them who are cool being suicide bombers and stuff. But if you tell them you're going to wipe them off the face of the planet, like, I'm sorry, they're going to get a deal done a little bit quicker. So, all right. So we have, again, I think one of the biggest tensions that's going to happen, certainly in our state, I imagine in California, some other sanctuary states with the incoming administration, is going to be around the issue of immigration. I have no reason to think that Donald Trump does not mean what he says when he says he's going to carry out mass deportations. So Washington state is going to do everything it can to stand in his way. They're going to forbid their law enforcement entities from helping with federal agents who are trying to carry that out within the state of Washington. So we'll cover that quite a bit. Florida, on the other hand, has every intention to do the exact opposite. Ron DeSantis, Governor Ron DeSantis, had a press conference yesterday where he's talking about having a special session to lay out and plan for cooperation with Donald Trump in this regard.
We are not approaching the new administration in a lackadaisical fashion. We in Florida have a sense of urgency to accomplish this mission. And the mission is very simple. We need to end the illegal immigration crisis once and for all in these United States of America.
Love the law enforcement behind him. Like, yeah, we got your back, man. So he's going to get down to business. Miranda watched that press conference. She looked at the plan that Governor Ron DeSantis has to make sure that Florida is cooperating with Donald Trump in mass deportation. And she joins us in our segment, Florida Report.
It's not even controversial anymore.
People know in Florida their freedoms are going to be respected.
Hello, Miranda. Love the hat. Love the hat.
Thank you. It's from my favorite podcast.
You know, we still have like a few of those left in the merch store. If anyone wants to buy one, undividedpod.com. We're working on new merch. Miranda is currently, as we speak, working on new merch. So TBD on all of that. All right, let's just talk about this Florida, what they're going to do to help Trump carry out mass deportations. So it's interesting because over in like our states, like our new governor had a committee of his transition team dedicated to Trump Project 2025, and California just set aside $50 million to like fight Trump in court for reasons unknown. And in Florida, Ron DeSantis says in their special session, that's going to be about carrying out Trump's mass deportation plan. So before we get into details, I mean, Florida has a lot of immigrants, but yeah, that doesn't mean they're illegal immigrants.
Correct. I mean, we have a, especially in Miami, we have a huge population of Cuban Americans. I'm sure we still have plenty of illegal ones, but a lot of the Cubans that I know take a lot of pride in having come here through the legal pathways. And a lot of my friends and stuff from South America, I see it all the time. They're always posting, like when they're at the courthouse, getting their U.S. citizenships and stuff like that. They take a lot of pride in doing it the right way. So I'm sure that we have our collection of illegals, but the ones that came here through the correct pathways, they really are proud of that. And they make sure that we know and people know that they did the right thing and came here legally.
Yeah. And so I think that, and this is something that isn't covered enough. Like people treat immigrants like a monolith, like, oh my gosh, you must not support deportation. If you're an immigrant, you came here. It's like, no, I spent X amount of money in 10 years trying to get here legally. And I pay all the tax and all the fees and all these things. So I'm very curious to see how this kind of goes over in Florida, local media and all of that. But so let's go through. First of all, you watched his press conference. Love a good Ron DeSantis press conference. What stands out to you from it?
I mean, the same things that always stand out to me when he kind of gets up there with something very important in mind. He is very direct. He's very concise in what he says. And he really does mean what he says. And he really spoke very profoundly about how this is a great opportunity, having Trump coming into office and getting the support of some of these Republicans in Florida that ran on the platform that this illegal immigration situation is a problem. he doesn't expect a lot of people to like sit on their hands now that we have somebody in the White House to really help enforce moving forward with actually like solving the issue. And then I really just like, I just like the way he like, he speaks to people. I feel like you can, he puts things in layman's terms without cutting out any important information. And I just enjoyed listening to him speak as always.
Yeah, it's interesting. I was talking the other day about just the juxtaposition between Governor Gavin Newsom and how he speaks about the wildfires versus like Gavin Newsom and the hurricanes. It's such a different style of leadership. I mean, I hate to even call what Gavin Newsom does leadership, but it's just, I wish I every state in an emergency had a Ron DeSantis to sort of lead them through it, because he really does shine in that regard. And you're right. I think this press conference was an example of that. So he put out these steps that they're going to take to carry out Trump's mandate to enforce the nation's immigration laws. What are some of them?
So some of the proposals he's putting forward are law enforcement compliance, which would basically have law enforcement at the state and county levels participating as much as they can and having all the support they can to enforce a lot of these, you know, federal programs for illegal immigration.
And can I just note on that, with penalties for noncompliance?
Yeah.
So if you're
up to suspension of officials for noncompliance.
Yeah, if you're not carrying out or you're obstructing the federal government in its efforts to carry out federal law on immigration, then Ron DeSantis might take action against you. And I think that's just as important as urging compliance.
For sure. Right, I think if anything requires compliance, there has to be a penalty for noncompliance. Otherwise, what's the point?
What's the point? 100%. All right, what else you got?
So state immigration enforcement officer would basically be somebody appointed to make sure that these proposals are being handled correctly. People have the manpower they need. Basically, somebody just appointed to oversee this whole situation goes fluidly.
Yeah, and that's what Pam Bondi talked a little bit about. Obviously, Florida Attorney General, who's likely to be the next Attorney General of the United States. Yeah. She talked about that in her congressional hearing yesterday. Like, we have to have, having been in that state law enforcement capacity, we have to have better cooperation between the federal government, state governments, localities when it comes to carrying out some of these things. So, and that is, I mean, if you're not working, you're going, Trump wants to go out and deport. I'm hoping they start with people who've, you know, committed serious crimes, et cetera. He has to go into states, blue states, red states, and all of these things. The level of cooperation those states give is going to have a direct correlation to how successful his efforts are. So obviously in Florida, they're like, we gotcha. They're even going to help transport the illegal aliens to where they need to go.
Yep, absolutely. That's another proposal. Although we already have a transport system in place, it's basically just going to expand that system and make sure that that system is supported in the way it needs to be supported so that these deportations can happen a little bit more effectively.
Yeah, a little more swiftly.
Yeah. In addition to that, they're also talking about criminal penalties for illegal immigration at the state level. Of course, there is penalties at the federal level, but what about the states? Can the states create a law that allows them within the state to prosecute and deport, just to kind of like add that extra layer of support that the federal government, like you said, needs? Because unless states are compliant, how can the federal government do anything?
Yeah, a couple other things I'll tick through, and then I want to end with you with the bail and flight risk presumptions, because I think that's important. They're going to ramp up gang enforcement, especially around gangs that might have originated in a different country where you have illegal immigrants who are participating in gang activity. Educational and voting reforms, repealing in-state tuition for illegal immigrant students, requiring voter registration affirmation of U.S. citizenship, which hopefully they're doing that already. Increased penalties for unauthorized aliens committing voter fraud or providing false voter registration information. Love all of that. Also, remittance and financial oversight. You know, I think one of the things they're trying to get at here is like, it's more difficult to exist in society if you're here illegally. Like, what can we do to make sure that this isn't like in the sanctuary state? I said on the show the other day, it's like they want there to be no difference between a lawful U.S. citizen and an illegal immigrant. It's like, so that's what they're trying to get away from. Can we talk about the bail and flight risk presumption thing?
Yeah, for sure. I think part of me thinks this is kind of obvious.
Yeah.
If an illegal immigrant commits a crime,
right,
I do not think that they should be, you know, given a bail, because obviously they are a flight risk. They could easily leave and never come back. So that's basically what this is kind of like a enforcement of making sure that there's something in place that allows us to not give bail opportunities and options to illegal immigrants who commit crimes.
Yeah, it says create a rebuttable presumption that illegal aliens are flight risks and deny bail. And that's 100%. You're looking at, when you set bail, you know, what's the likelihood they'll reappear and how do you weigh that against their constitutional rights, like as an American citizen, essentially. I mean, you still have rights in this country, even if you are here illegally. That's the way America works. But I don't think that that's unreasonable to say, no, you're here illegally. You committed a crime. And you're probably, it's pretty easy. It was easy for you to get here. It's probably pretty easy for you to go back. And we want to make sure we hold you accountable. So I love this. And he ends it saying, let's get to work. Let's get to work. I love it. I'm curious how all this is going to play out. Again, there's going to be a huge discrepancy between what happens there and what happens in Washington State. And I think that's part of the reason we have this segment, right? Is you see this is night and day from what is going to transpire here. And so it'll be interesting to compare and contrast. All right, Miranda, you look great in that hat, by the way. You're a perfect model.
Thank you. I wore it to model whatever stock you have left. So if anybody wants to get one.
Yep, we have a few left before we just wipe everything clean and get that new merch in. So, you know, get your hat now. All right, Miranda, we appreciate it.
Bye.
It's not even controversial anymore.
People know in Florida their freedoms are going to be respected.
Miranda's apparently a good hat model because as soon as we said that, people started buying our hats that we have left. So love it. All right. A lot going down in California still. We continue to kind of monitor and talk about the fires and just travesty down there. But there's also the economic impact to consider. I mean, Florida has this massive economy, right? It's a bigger economy than most countries. And when you have that level of destruction to things like homes, there is very clearly going to be an economic impact of that kind of when, for lack of a better phrase, the dust settles and the fires are out, et cetera. So we asked our friend Zach Abraham with Bulwark Capital to come on and discuss that angle of the California fires.
The ripple effects are really personal, meaning, so if we want to look at like GDP, right, or gross domestic product of the entire country or an individual state, an event like this can actually make that number go higher. And the reason it'll do that is because think all the people that are displaced, all the money that requires that they spend while they're living in a hotel or something like that. Then you have the cost to rebuilding. So on the surface of it, it can actually appear like it's somewhat of an economic boost. But the personal costs are significant, obviously. And in California, they're going to be even higher because of the amount of homes that weren't insured, right? And so it won't show up so much economic or economy-wide, but I think it's going to cause, you know, obviously a significant amount of financial and just lifestyle hardship for a lot of these people. You know, I mean, you got people that have lost $2.5-3 million houses that weren't insured. I want to frame this in a way because in no way I like to think of myself as a very empathetic person. It's a tragedy to watch what's happening down there. I don't wish it on anybody, including my own worst enemy. But this is yet another example of how significantly our culture needs a reintroduction to the term caveat emptor, right? Buyer beware.
Yeah.
Because what unfortunately the people in California have literally gotten precisely what they elected. And by that, I don't mean bad Democrats. I mean incompetence, right? I know for a fact there are liberals and even progressives in that state that could do a pretty good job of running LA and they could do a good job of running their state. The problem is that isn't who they've elected. They've elected nonsensical, idiotic, borderline mentally disabled morons, and they've done it for completely ideological reasons. And then they want to look around and go, who could have seen this coming? Like, I don't know, if I run a restaurant and I hire my head chef and he's a plumber, I probably shouldn't expect to deliver great meals to people, and I probably shouldn't be surprised when my restaurant closes, right? So I feel horrible for them. But at the same time, it reminds me of a statement Barack Obama made once. Elections have consequences. California, here you go.
Yeah. Cole was just talking before we got online. Like, we have Daryl who works with us, you know, they're doing work on his house. And she was like, you need to buy your lumber because, you know, are there any goods that you think just because of this, these fires in California for the rest of us are going to go through the roof?
Yeah. So if you're planning on doing any, I thought that was really smart by Nicole, by the way. I hadn't really thought about that angle, but absolutely. And you see these same kinds of things happen after hurricanes, right? The prices of this stuff will go up. If you're planning on doing any of this, I think Nicole is right. I think the cost of pre-purchasing, I think there's zero risk to pre-purchasing stuff that you're planning on using. It may not go up and it may not go up a lot, but it's not going to go down. So I definitely think, yeah, if you're doing any type of remodeling, if you, whatever, go out and pre-purchase those things now before the rebuild starts, because it, you know, especially in this marketplace, it will increase the prices on that stuff. Yeah. 100%.
Yeah. It just makes sense. So, you know, and it's sad, you're like, people lose their homes, all this, but you know, we talk all the time about people leaving Washington State over the politics. I mean, if you're a business and you had your business burned down or your home burned down or whatever it is, I think we're going to see flight from California. I think I hate to say easier because the way that you're leaving, but like if you've lost everything and you wanted to leave anyway, I feel like people are going to take off.
And this is the kind of thing, man. I swear to God, California, it's like beaten wife syndrome, right? Like it's like they just keep going back to the same well. To be fair, you know, especially you start talking about Southern California and San Diego, it's some of the most beautiful real estate on planet Earth. I mean, the place it's a Shangri-La, right? It's, which I understand the draw, but at a certain point, I mean, you're looking at a state government in California that is truly testing the bounds of citizens. Like, how bad can we bungle things and have people not leave? Like, that's the game they're playing. And the other thing that kills me about this whole, and we're talking about climate change, people in the know, including Los Angeles Fire Department, have been saying this was going to happen for 25 years.
Mm-hmm.
Like there's no ambiguity. This isn't a surprise to anybody that was paying attention. And it was predicted to do this exact same thing. They said it'd roll through LA proper right to the ocean. That's mm-hmm. what it's doing. And we had 40% of the fire hydrants non-operational. I mean, And when you know, to me, it's just the ultimate failure of progressive politics and DEI policies. You, Brandy, you know it with your career and your business. Making a career or making a business is successful, it is extraordinarily difficult, even if you are myopically focused on all of the important things, right? But when you are selecting people to run a business or an organization, and you're not even taking into consideration their ability to actually do that job,
yeah,
your chances of success are zero, right? Like it's hard enough when you're pointed in the right direction. If you're not even looking at the right direction, your chances of success are zero.
100%. Zach Abraham and his team at Bulwark Capital, they're going to have another one of their Know Your Risk webinars, this one coming up on Thursday, January 30th. You can sign up for free. It's just a great way. They'll give you kind of a overview of the new administration, how its policies might impact retirement portfolios. They'll talk about the current state of the market and give an outlook for all of 2025 and a full reveal of how Bulwark is always looking for opportunities to lower risk, lower cost, and give your retirement as much upside as possible. You only get one retirement. Get a second opinion. So the webinar is completely free. You can sign up right now by going to knowyourriskradio.com. That's knowyourriskradio.com. Okay, to our daily subscriber show poll, sort of say. Daily subscriber show poll. I asked subscribers on Patreon, Locals, and X, which of new Governor Bob Ferguson's executive orders do you believe is most important? The building regulations and efforts to streamline those, codifying access to abortion, or permitting and licensing, cutting red tape for permitting and licensing. Nicole, abortion access, right?
Yeah. I would say, well, I don't know that most important is, I guess, building regulations, if that actually works to bring down the cost of housing, I guess. But the permitting and licensing might affect the most people.
Yeah.
I think that if that really goes across the board and they actually do something, because really his order just says look at it. It doesn't really say do anything. And then there's like the refund if you don't get paid and or if you don't get the permit in time. But really, that could be like $30. But if they actually streamline this process for people, that could be huge.
Yeah, not a shock that not too many of you are saying abortion access. Pretty evenly split between building regulations and permitting and licensing. Cynthia says, please, yes. We've been in a permitting process since before COVID.
Yes.
Going on terrible. 5 years now just to sublot some property. Cheapers, creepers. Mouse Killers says permits should be easy to get as coffee, but hire a buttload of new certified building inspectors. Many retired contractors and foremen or tradesmen could fill that role. Ricky, without reading what the building and permit licensing reforms actually are, I can't vote, but it would be one of those. Yes, Rick wanted more information. Let me see. Chris says, none of them. Executive orders usurp the role of the legislature. Not that that group is a bunch of winners, he says, in parentheses. Greg says, I hope there is more of this coming. I just want to see if he makes good on these, and then we'll see what else he has in store. The abortion one is just to appease the... It's like, oh, I got to throw something ideologically driven in there. So yep. Abortion, you absolutely. Know, it's just ridiculous.
You know, I don't know if you saw this story in the news, but the Clealum has this big lawsuit going because this builder bought all of this land there. Yeah. And it's been, I think he's had it for 20 years. And Clealum keeps putting off his permits and licensing. And he just won a lawsuit. They have to pay him like millions of dollars. And so the city is going to have to. Might have to declare bankruptcy and then let the legislature like deal with their funds. So it's a big deal because they have that power to just delay mm-hmm. permitting and licensing if they just don't like the project. Right. So that's the thing, is they didn't like the project. And so now they're in hot water over it.
It's a small town. You can't.
It's a very small town.
$1 million.
But I mean, this could be huge for a lot of people. Like she was saying that. I mean, it's just ridiculous how they delay permitting.
Yeah. Although over on local, some people are saying that they want some sort of executive order on public safety. Brenda says, none of the above. Mm-hmm. Public safety needs to be his top priority. Caddy says, I thought he ran on more police officers and a tough on crime bill. These look like the same old Marxist DEI agendas. My vote is for none of the above. Dr. Sarah says, what about orders that improve public safety, schools, social issues like homelessness? I mean, abortion access? Really? Exactly. Your third one could have been something related to an actual crisis in Washington State. Mm-hmm. Not abortion access to please your base. Just ridiculous. All right. Let's get to some other comments.
An executive order for a round table. Why don't you just tell your employees, hey, go have a meeting.
Go have a meeting.
Like, executive order for that.
Go sit at a table. If it has to be round, so Lordy. Be it. Zsa Zsa Brownie with $1.99 super chat. Cute top. Thanks. It's actually a dress. Bill Biz, the $20 super chat. Woo! Reparental rights. The idea of the legislature adopting a successful citizen initiative in order to subsequently gut it is appalling and should be illegal. I agree. Janelle Viegas, yep, Dory's legacy. His fight, his stand-up for our region, carried on proudly. Brandy and Nicole behind you, 100%. Thank you. Greg Olakis, calling for a review is not going to change anything, and this will cut no red tape. Salmon over people is Washington State's motto. Wouldn't that be a great state motto on a license plate? Washington State, salmon over people. Like, I love some salmon, you know, but not over people. Unless it's at the dinner table, then yes, salmon over people.
By the way, I think that's why, right, that's one of the reasons maybe some of the reservoirs were not filled in California was because they were trying to save fish. And
salmon over people.
It might be a thing that we all need to adopt people over salmon, although we love the salmon too.
Yes.
But down there, Newsom's doing the same, cutting all those regulations so you can get things built. Why don't we just do that in the first place? Why only in emergency situations when we're short on housing and we need like to recover after burning everybody out of their homes? Yeah. Like, why don't we just cut all those things?
Because all
to
that
begin with?
Makes money for the government. You know, the interesting thing is that he had this, Gavin Newsom had this comment to that effect where he's like, we're going to cut the red tape and bureaucracy for people. So you're admitting there's red tape and bureaucracy. If you're admitting it, then you can fix it, right? Let me see. Sandy says, legacy news isn't news. Hasn't been for a long time. Grateful for you and our state. Thank you. Steven, smoke and mirrors again. Bob's the problem. He wants us to forget. I won't. No. 25 years of failure. I'm not forgiving for one nice speech. Ridiculous. Marksman Hitman, you can tell when the devil is lying because if his mouth moves, it's always lies and deception. Just my opinion. Jenny, I think Bob had an epiphany based on Trump's big win. He is smart and doesn't like to lose, most of all. He might do good things to remain in power and gain esteem. He's going to play it very carefully. It's what I said on the show a couple days ago. He wants, it's always a chess move. He's always looking for his next move. So what's up from here? The presidency, right? Or to be a senator or something. And he's looking at what are the Democrats, like what's the vibe nationally for Democrats? The progressive was just rejected. And one of the most popular Democratic governors in the country is Josh Shapiro, who will probably run for president in 2028 because he's more moderate, he's more reasonable. And I think that Bob's just trying to emulate what he thinks is the political movement of the moment that he needs to be a part of. All right, Lynn, large companies already have to abide by the WARN Act, which says if you're laying off 50 people or more, they have to give 60 days notice. Mm-hmm. So if large companies already have to do this because of a federal act, now Sean Scott just wants to apply it to smaller companies? That doesn't seem very fair.
That seems really unfair. And I was mentioning this at some point that that like smaller companies, when you give somebody 60 days notice to leave a job, a lot of times they're a little retaliatory. So you have to have that ability to say, hey, this is not going to be best for my company if you stay here and you're mad at me and now you're going to like go steal all my clients or you're going to, we had this at the radio station, like you just kind of tell people and you hand them a box because otherwise there's a liability. They might go on air and say something they shouldn't say or whatever it is. Now, I wish there was a little more leeway in that. Yeah. Let people say goodbye to the listeners, things like that. But I get the liability because, I mean, people are retaliatory.
Yeah.
So you have to have that protection,
and
too.
If you can lay off and say, hey, here's 60 days, here's 2 months pay, but you're being laid off, then isn't that the same thing as, like, you know, giving notice? Right. It's like you can 60 days to go do unemployment. This. Right. Yeah. It's just ridiculous. And it's not like they're not going to get unemployment benefits. Okay. A couple more. Tyrone, can an American go to Mexico illegally and start living? Will they give you a free debit card? Probably not. Probably I don't think that's happening down there. And Marksman with a $10 super chat. Please, everyone here, hit that like button. Keep up the good work and shows. Yes, hit that like button.
That's nice.
Tim Pool says, smash that like button. All right, good comments per the usual. And with that, let's get to a delightful closing sanity check. All right, if you thought the Seattle City Council was bad, in Massachusetts, a council member is taking a mental health month. 1 month off for their mental health after being misgendered.
Worcester City Councilor at Large Tu Nguyen taking a month-long mental health break, accusing the mayor and council of a toxic culture. Nguyen uses the pronouns they, them, and says it's not safe to show up to meetings in person.
I really, really wished I felt safe enough to show up on the council floor. But I don't.
Last night, when talking about remote participation, Nguyen accused the mayor and another councilor, Kathleen Toomey, of using the wrong pronouns. Nguyen also says councilor Candy Merrow Carlson repeatedly called them it.
I have faced transphobia with being misgendered and recently learned that I have been dehumanized to a point where I'm being referred to as it by my colleagues on this council.
Councillor Toomey says early on when the councillor was elected, I did make an honest error in addressing the councillor and may have done so a few times, for which I apologized. There has never been any intentional or consistent misgendering. I have been mindful to address the councillor respectfully in the manner in which they identify over the past 3 years.
I have spoken with city staff, who've confirmed that Councilor Nguyen was referred to as an it by a counselor.
Councilor Christian King troubled by what he's heard.
I condemn and disavow any sort of political hostility based on someone's being.
Well, the good news is the city does have a DEI department, and so this counselor has filed a complaint with the city's DEI department, so maybe we'll have an update on the possible consequences. Soon. It's a little mean. I will say. It's not cool.
No, not to call somebody it.
No, but I'm not doing the they, them thing. I'll call you by your name.
Exactly.
So if anybody called them.
And that.
Anybody
the
called Nguyen.
Was never confirmed. She admitted to misgendering.
They deny the it part. The one counselor says, well, I've confirmed it that this did happen by talking to other people. She says that she does not recall that.
You don't need a month off.
You don't need a month off for your mental health, right? That's not what voters elected you for. That has been our sanity check for today. That has been today's episode of Undivided. That has been this week's episodes of Undivided. Thank you for being here on Sundays with subscribers this week. We're talking about owls. Woo! Woo! We're talking about the federal government wanting to murder a bunch of owls for the steep price tag of billions of dollars, and some Oregon lawmakers trying to get Doge involved. Wants to kill owls. That's just cruel, right? That's weird. So we'll have that on Sundays with subscribers. If you have not signed up to support our show already, why not? We're having a great time. On your $5 subscription every month helps us continue this work of ours. So undividedpod.com, undividedpod.com. And don't forget, starting tomorrow, we will be a return to our weekly segment, Politics Unpacked. It'll post across platforms on Fridays, helping you just get a hold of what happened in the legislative session each week. So enjoy.